hopeless. I feel but one way. You will understand it too. In these words that I say, I'll close my eyes to everyone but you. And when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guests are authors Susan Siegel and Diana Abu-Jabbar. Susan Siegel teaches creative writing at the University of Southern California, and her short stories have been published in Red Book and in literary journals, and they have won awards from QPB Story Magazine, Snake Nation Review, Iowa Woman, and Sideshow Anthology. An excerpt from Aria, the novel we're going to discuss today, won honorable mention in the Dana Award in the novel. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Barbara.
I have to tell you, I just finished this book yesterday, Aria, published by Berkeley Signature Edition, and I just loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Thank you so much.
Tell me a bit about how it came about.
It was actually the result of a number of different things, sort of ideas coming together. I had been wanting for a while actually to write about opera because I had become a sort of amateur opera fanatic in the previous few years before I started writing. And it's pretty hard to just write about opera, so that was kind of just rolling around in my head. And then around the time that that was happening, I also actually read about an actual event in the newspaper in which a family from Southern California that had pretty much done what the characters in my book do, which is that the family with two children, and they had sold everything, bought a boat, and decided to sail around the world with their children for 5 years. And about 2 years into their trip, they were hit by a freighter, and everyone in the family was killed except for the mother, who survived and actually washed up on the shores of, I think it was New Zealand. In my book, it's Australia. And I read about that and heard about that and was just so, I don't know why that story struck me so much, but sometimes I just talk about, I think that it has to do with the fact that I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s, when the sort of defining events of our lives were various horrible events of assassinations in the Vietnam War and all of that, and that I think my generation, to a certain extent, grew up with this sort of morbidity about life and this sense of trying to find a purpose for your life. And I thought, after you've lost everything in your life that matters to you, how can you possibly want to go on with your life? And that question haunted me. And so I just began to imagine the life of this woman after she survived the accident. I wasn't so interested in her life before the accident. And I began to think about what opera has meant to me in terms of kind of getting into my soul and helping me kind of express things that, or feel things that are sometimes hard to feel, because opera is so large and grand and full of just the basic human emotions. And so slowly the genesis of Aria was born. What would happen if this particular woman who is recovering from a terrible accident comes into contact with the world of opera and, in fact, finds a haven with an opera singer in order to physically recover, and in so doing also kind of falls in love with opera and a little bit back with life again, and finds a way to go on with her life. So that's kind of how it was born, and didn't quite know where it was going when I began, but I knew that somehow opera was going to be a huge part of it.
So did you have any idea, you just said you didn't know where it was going, but did you have any idea of sort of the major plot points or where you would end up?
I knew where I would end up in a very, very general way. I knew that I wanted her life to be better at the end than it was at the beginning. I wanted her to have found something in life worth going on for, because otherwise I'm not sure I'd see the point in writing the book. And so I knew that in a very general way. I actually knew very few of the plot points. I knew that she would be a person who would find it very difficult to feel the full scope of feelings there were to feel, you know, just because she would be too overwhelmed, and that she would begin to listen to opera and start crying over all the dying heroines in opera and in a way be able to find some release for herself. But I knew that I was going to introduce a complication in the lives of the people she went to live with. She goes to live with this opera singer and her husband, and they are hosting a very young opera composer who's writing an opera for this diva who's quite famous. And I knew that he was going to present complications. But I really didn't know exactly what or how. And in fact, I got to a certain point in the book in which I was working very hard to make certain things not happen, and yet they insisted on happening. So,
like what?
Well, the young composer, whose name is Noah, is we discover fairly early on in the novel, is probably having an affair with the opera singer, unbeknownst, obviously, to the husband. But Eve, who is the main character, who's living in the guest house on this estate, suspects, and then pretty much discovers that they are having an affair, and which kind of causes her to feel even more alienated from them at first. But in fact, she's sort of thrown together with Noah, and in spite of herself, becomes very drawn to him and can see the attraction for the opera singer. And he truly becomes her friend, which I definitely wanted to have happen in the book. But what I didn't want to have happen is I did not want them to get involved in any way romantically. And I was absolutely determined that they wouldn't, but I think they were absolutely determined that they would. So, because I thought, oh, that's such a cliche, and that's so, you know, that's so romance novel-ish. But, you know, the way I think they ended up coming together, they taught me, is, you know, in to me, a fairly realistic way. He doesn't save her from anything. He doesn't renew her life, but he is a step in the process of her recovery.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Susan Siegel, author of the novel Aria. Will you read to us?
Certainly, I would
be
glad.
Great.
I thought I would read just a little part. Actually, it's perfect timing because I'm going to read a part between Eve and Noah. I have to just set it up a little bit. This house that she has gone to live in is owned by the opera singer, whose name is Isabel, and it's in upstate New York, and next to a small sort of country, nice little town called Kent. And Eve and Noah are alone on the estate right now because Isabel is performing in the city and her husband is with her. So they've sort of been thrown together, and they've become friendly. She's still quite wary of him, but she's starting to trust him a little, and he drives her into town to shop for groceries since she's kind of on her own, and although they sometimes eat together. So this is a scene where he takes her to the grocery store in Kent, and I think the only thing else you need to know, her children were a boy and a girl named Nick and Jessica, and she's been on a boat. She was living on a boat for what was supposed to be 4 years, so this is a scene in which she's thinking about the kind of provisions and everything that you had to get when you were living on the boat. So I think that should do it.
Okay.
The drive into Kent is less than 10 minutes. I ride the whole way with my eyes fixed on the scenery, keeping my mind blank. Identical clapboard houses dot the hillside. The houses look compact and comfortable, as if families who get along with their neighbors must live in them. The main street is less than a mile long and looks like Disneyland, like a street in Disneyland. The market is small, with aisles so narrow the shopping carts are doll-sized. Noah grabs a cart and walks in ahead of me. I follow him blindly with a cart of my own, pulling necessary items off the shelf while barely looking at them. Rice, tuna, 7-Up, Jessica's favorite, but I got Coke last time for Nick. Dried kidney beans, a few steaks, powdered milk, first brands I see, no comparison shopping today, no references to my meticulously crafted budget or shopping list, because really, I don't think I could bear to see Jessie's shaky scrawl or Nick's painstaking one, because inevitably one or both of them would find the list and add in their 2 cents, nail polish, a book, post toasties. By the time I reach the checkout, my cart is full and Noah is there unloading. When he sees me, he stops, a box of echinacea tea in his braced hand. What? I say. Nothing. Just that's quite a load you have there. It's supplies. He hoists up the sack of rice. What will you do with all this, he says. We'll cook it. What do you think we'll do? Silence. Noah continues to stare, and now I notice the cashier is staring too. Noah lowers the rice back into my cart. It's just that it seems like an awful lot of rice, Eve, he says gently. I mean, 10 pounds of rice will last you a very, very long time, won't it? And all the rest of this stuff? We need it for our... It's... I look in the cart and see everything I would buy on a supply run for the boat, bought without thinking or even checking to see if we were out, because except for the steaks, which were meant to be a treat since we hadn't had meat in so long, we always used up these supplies, always needed them replenished. Oh, I say, fumbling in my purse, I have the right list somewhere. Here. Noah puts his tea back in his cart and comes over to me. He takes the list I've dug out of my bag and puts his other arm around me, tight. Let me take you back to the car, he says. I need some things, I manage to say. I'll get them for you. He guides me out of the store. I'm sure he's annoyed and embarrassed by me, thinking how he didn't sign on to take care of a crazy person. When he comes back to the car, I am sitting with my head back, eyes closed, my brain ricocheting between the reality of the cold car and the dream of this only being a port of call, being nowhere that I have to stay. I hear him open the car trunk and feel the car dip with the weight of the packages. Then he gets in the front seat, blowing on his red hands. "It wants to be winter out there," he says. Then, after a minute, "You all right?" "I'm sorry," I say. He fumbles the keys in the ignition. The engine turns over. He fiddles with the car heater, pulls his gloves from his pockets, and puts them on, then grips the top of the steering wheel as if bracing himself. "I guess you felt sick," he says. "Something like that." I feel him look at me again. "It's just that I haven't been in a store in a while," I say, to intercept his stare. "I got confused." He gives a little forced laugh. "Hell, it usually takes me 20 minutes to remember if I like gel or paste toothpaste. At least you knew what you wanted." "Well," I say, "you learn to move like lightning once you start shopping with children." It just came out unbidden, the word, children, exploding like blasphemy. "Oh," Noah says, "I'm sorry. I forgot this was your first trip to town, to a store." He looks so anguished that I have the real urge to pat his cheek. "Don't be," I say. "I never liked shopping that much. It was a pain in the ass, if you want to know the truth." He smiles hesitantly. You had a boy and a girl?" I nod. The car heater kicks in at last, and the car begins to warm up. The engine thrums. Noah never takes his eyes from me. "What were their names?" "Nicholas and Jessica." I speak their names aloud to Noah, sending the syllables out into the freezing air for the first time since I voiced them that night, screamed them into the oblivious sea. Then he says, "Do you want to go get a cup of coffee?" And I say, "I want to go get a drink."
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Susan Siegel reading from Aria. That scene was so moving, and throughout the book. I mean, you have this woman who has lost her children and husband in a boating accident in the middle of the ocean. You're a mother. How was it to write? I mean, you're living your life. You're, you know, dealing with being a mother, and this woman's kids are gone.
Yeah. Well, actually, when I wrote the earliest draft for this book, I was not a mother. So I think that's how I wrote it. Honestly, by the time I was editing the first draft, I had just had my son. To tell you the truth, I actually do not think I would have written this novel had he already been born.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that I had to get so deep inside of Eve's head. I mean, Eve is very much like me, and in many ways not like me at all, but I had to get so deep inside her head that I really could imagine being that woman. But now that there's a living, breathing child out there, I don't want to go there. I just don't want to go to the place of imagining him being gone. So I just don't think I would have been able to bring myself to write it. So I'm lucky that although I was working on it when he was born, I had done a draft before.
Yeah, Yeah.
But, you know, ironically, I will say that I will say every once in a while someone will say to me, I couldn't finish it. It was too painful. I'm a mother. But most mothers, most parents actually respond to the book very positively, that they don't find it depressing. They don't find it something that, you know, they can't bring themselves to read because they have children, because there's something, I don't know why, but there's something about it that sort of transcends that for them. And I've done some readings where I've had women come up to me and tell me that they've lost a child and that I've really captured a lot of what that feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's somehow cathartic to them rather than painful, you know?
Yeah. Well, I found it, the idea of the premise of the book difficult before I started reading.
Yes,
it.
Yes.
But I have to say, your writing is so elegant and literary and lovely, and the voice just really caught me. And mm-hmm. I wanted to stay in that sort of that world that you'd created. And I wanted to talk about voice too. How did you get to the voice of
Eve
for the book of Eve? Yeah.
That's a difficult question to answer because on the one hand I feel as if I'm not sure I know, and on the other hand I think, well, it's just me exaggerated. For some reason, what I didn't want to do was write a character who is tragic in a generic kind of way. That is, that she would conform to the images that we have of someone who is tragic, that she would be very sad, that she would be very weak. very helpless and very sort of pathetic in a way that inspired pity in others and support. Because I felt like that didn't, what experience I've had of tragedy, I never felt like that. And what I found myself feeling a lot when I, in the tragedies that I've experienced in my life, is incredible anger and jealousy of everyone who isn't suffering the way that I'm suffering. And that's not very pretty, but that's authentically what my experience has been. I think I made Eve a little nastier than I am, but I do remember I lost a very dear friend when I was quite young, and I remember being just really kind of looking around every day and thinking, how can you just, you people just go on with your lives. This terrible thing has happened, and it's not fair that you're not suffering, and I'm the only one suffering, and there's two friends walking down the street, and they still get to be friends, and I don't have my friend anymore. And so I think that I wanted to capture that because that felt authentic to me. And so the voice arose around this sort of feeling that anger is an emotion that we are more willing to be in touch with than the pure collapse that we would feel if we really were in touch with our sadness over something like this. And so her voice sort of evolved out of being angry. And I have to say, in earlier drafts, she was way angrier and very nasty, and my editor kind of made me pull her back a little bit. Because she's not very, I mean, I think you'll agree, she's not terribly likable in the beginning of the story. She rejects offers of help. She's sort of abrupt with people. She's even at a certain point. Another part of the novel is this concept of how people become celebrities, because she's actually become somewhat famous for having been in this horrible accident and making the news. And people write her these letters, you know, telling her about their tragedies as a way of kind of reaching out to her and trying to get comfort for themselves and perhaps comfort her. And she writes back these really nasty letters like, why are you telling me your problems? And I meant that somewhat for comic relief, but I also felt that, you know, this felt authentic to me. So, I think I write characters who are very busy tamping down a lot of emotion. That tends to be a theme in my stories. And so I felt very much like I inhabited her, and that her voice was mine taken a little to the nth degree,
sure.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess she was unlikable in the beginning, but I liked that about her. I liked that she was just the way she was, and she was just reacting, you know, like, get away. I mean, that seemed authentic, that someone would be like that.
Mm-hmm.
What about, just a little, since we have a few minutes left, what about the selling of the book? Was that an easy process?
No. I think it never is with the first novel. We shot, my agent sent it around for close to a year. I got a lot of really, really good response, all of which was like, we love this, but we're going to pass.
Because?
From a lot of major houses.
Because?
I think that I would say that the consensus was that it was too small a story with an unknown writer. It was, you know, that the subject matter, it would be hard to market the subject matter, because when you try to describe what the novel is about, it sounds pretty bleak. And, you know, if I were, I don't know, you know, Amy Tan and had written such a novel, it would sell because I'm Amy Tan, but given that it's me and no one's heard of me, I think that it is, I hate to say this, but the larger publishing houses are truly backing off of taking, you know, that kind of chance on an unknown writer with a small literary book. It's clearly not going to be a blockbuster. It was optioned for a movie, but, you know, it still never became a bestseller or anything like that. And it was eventually sold to a small press called Bridgeworks, the hardback, and who did a fantastic job with it. Initially was wary of going with the small press, but they did an amazing job with the book. It sold really well. They sold the paperback rights to Berkeley, as you know, which is part of Penguin, and that was a great deal. So I really changed my tune about it. I really like small presses. The experience I had with them was really great. And so it was painful waiting to sell it, but it was really pleasurable from that point on.
Mm. Well, I loved the book.
Thank
so,
so
I
much.
Am, I'm going to be talking it up to everybody. I know.
Thank you.
We're at the end of our time. Do you have any advice for the writers listening who may be working their way through a long project?
Well, I think my advice is probably the same advice they've probably heard a million times, but speaking as someone who really didn't get her career going until almost midlife and who has been rejected probably more times than I care to count, just that crazy perseverance that you have to have, that sort of psyching yourself out and believing that there is someone out there at the end of this project who is really going to want to look at it, that you must not let rejection stop you, and that you must keep going if you believe in your work, no matter what.
Yeah.
It will happen eventually.
Mm. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you, Barbara.
For,
it's a pleasure.
For being here. And
My pleasure.
I hope it does become a film.
Thank you.
I want to
so
see it
I.
on the screen. I think it's totally filmic. It could be there just so easily.
I think especially now, you know, so many of the really celebrated actresses are now in their 40s, and the heroines in this novel are both in their, well, one's in their 50s.
Sure.
It's a great vehicle for any actors out there, two middle-aged female actors.
I think so. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Barbara.
That was Susan Siegel, author of Aria, a novel, a wonderful novel, with a beautiful cover. I'm a sucker for great covers, and this one is a good one. When we come back, we'll be here with Diana Abu-Jabbar. She's author of the memoir, The Language of Baklava. So please stay with us.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays at 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KUCI FM in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about the show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org. We also have podcasts up at this point, a few dozen shows, 36, 48, something like that. You go to writersonwriting.blogspot.com, and you can follow the path to the podcast. Or you go to iTunes and look for Writers on Writing, and you can listen to a whole bunch of shows. This one should be up next week. So and there's some from far back since I began here. 8, 9 years ago, whatever it was. Anyway, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my next guest is Diana Abu-Jabbar. Diana is the author of Crescent, which was awarded the 2004 Penn Center USA Award for Literary Fiction and the Before Columbus Foundation's American Book Award, and was named one of the 20 best novels of 2003 by the Christian Science Monitor, and Arabian Jazz, which won the 1994 Oregon Book Award and was nominated for the Penn Faulkner Award. Her current book is The Language of Baklava, a memoir. And Diana teaches at Portland State University and divides her time between Portland and Miami. Hi, Diana.
Hey, Barbara.
Good to see you, right, talk to you. I saw you right. Last month. The Language of Baklava, a memoir. Now, your last two books were novels, and yeah. Here's a memoir. Tell me about that.
I didn't intend to write a memoir. It was really something that kind of came about after I'd written Crescent, because Crescent was so involved with food that I'd done tons of research on all these different recipes, because, you know, the main character of Crescent is a chef, and she specializes in Middle Eastern food. She's from an Iraqi-American background, and so I had all these dishes and recipes. And I was talking with my editor, the woman who had edited Crescent, and she said, well, why don't you just go ahead with all this work? She said, you're from this big, crazy, food-obsessed family, and why don't you use this material? And I didn't think I would. I mean, I didn't think I had enough to say about my own family, and I always thought that memoir seemed really... like, you had to be a really important person to write one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Ulysses S. Grant or something. And, so I thought it was just too much. But once I started, you know, I started thinking about food and sort of distilling memories around food, I just discovered tons and tons of stuff. And since I wrote The Language of Baklava, all kinds of people have told me, yeah, this is true for them, you know, that they have these strong food memories from their own growing up lives. So I guess it's just a universal thing.
Were you worried at all about doing a memoir? Were you worried about what your relatives, what your parents, what people that you wrote about would think?
It's always a little tough. You know, I am from partially Middle Eastern background, and a lot of that community is very traditional. It's a little private, and I was raised, you know, to be very respectful and be very, very careful, and so it felt extremely risky, like I was telling secrets. And the thing is, though, with my family, they're already so upset that I've written novels that it's like I was already in trouble. So I figured, well, what the heck, you know, they're already mad. I may as well just go for it. And it's actually quite liberating as you write, if you can just kind of take that attitude, like, it's too late, I'm already in trouble,
mm-hmm.
you know, just say it.
Did you end up running any of the chapters or the manuscript by anybody before you handed it in?
You know, I very deliberately did not.
Mm-hmm.
I knew if I showed anyone the manuscript, they would very likely have opinions, and I'm extremely susceptible. When people give me advice or opinions, I listen, and, you know, I was just really worried that I would, you know, cut way back on what I was doing, so I waited.
I'm talking with Diana Abu-Jabbar, author of The Language of Baklava. Along those same lines, do you have readers, or do you have a critique group, or do you have anybody that you show chapters to, or is that, do you also keep your work private until say you have a finished draft so that the influence would be minimized?
Actually, I love getting feedback from non-relatives. I do. I have a wonderful writing group here in Miami. I belong to a writing group back in Portland. Wonderful women writers. You know, we didn't set out to be a women-only group; just sort of happened that way. And then I also have friends. You know, my friend Michelle Hunnivan in Los Angeles reads mm-hmm. my work, and I have a friend in West Virginia who I send work to. And you know, it's I really believe in getting feedback. I love getting people's eyes. You know, it's so valuable because you kind of memorize your work after a while and you can't see it anymore.
Yeah. At what point do you do that? Do you wait till you're far into a project before you start getting feedback, or do you want it pretty quick?
I want it quick, but I try to resist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and very much for that reason that we were talking about earlier about being kind of a permeable writer. I know that if somebody doesn't like something, I take everybody's opinion as solid gold, and I think sometimes I'm a little too permeable. So I try to have as strong of a sense of the story arc, let's say, as I can before I start showing it to people. And, you know, I try not to send work out, you know, try to sell manuscripts that are partial, or, you know, I try to get it as close as I can to at least one finished draft before I send it to friends or to editors.
Mm-hmm. Will you read to us?
Sure.
And if you just tuned in, you're a little bit late, but we have Diana Abu-Jabbar with us for about 15 more minutes, and she's the author of The Language of Baklava, published by Anchor Books, and she's going to read.
Okay. I thought I would read this section, and this is when my family goes back to Jordan for the first time, and my father is from a Bedouin background. And so one day he decides that we're going to go back into the country and meet the original tribe that he's from. He grew up in the town, but this was our excursion to the country. And I'll just read
okay.
a page or two. I begin to understand that spending a day with the Bedouins is not so different from spending a day with my father's family in town. The men and women drift into their separate activities. Lanira takes me by the hand and leads me to a large, fire-heated rock. Here, a crone with a black, seared face sits flat on the ground, one leg to either side of the wide stone. Another woman mixes flour and water. Another pats the dough into shape, and the crone tosses this onto the hot stone where it puffs up. Another woman plucks the hot bread from the rock, and yet another places it in a stack of loaves. They laugh and chatter, and their bodies relax into the murmurous air. It reminds me of a dance, the ring of interlaced participants. I sit among the women, my body filled with the charged scent of the bread, the lilt of their voices. I'm understanding more and more of what they're saying, and it finally dawns on me that they're speaking Arabic. It's a stiff, bookish sort of Arabic, the kind in our school textbooks, classical Arabic from hundreds of years ago, the verbs and pronouns more time-worn than thee and thou. One of the women points her tattooed chin at me. What does she eat? She asks Munira. I like jameed, I pipe up, and za'atar, and chewing gum and hot chocolate. The women all stop what they're doing and stare at me. The crone hoots. She speaks. Munira smiles, a modest little smile. A bit, she says. But why does she speak like that, the first woman says, like a cat eating a bone. Munira shrugs. They all talk like that in the city. Come on, child, the crone urges me. Say more. Unfortunately, I wasn't born with the ability to think on the spot. I open my mouth, take a deep breath, and blurt out, bread, table, mouse. The women laugh, and the crone doubles over, almost falling onto the hot rock. I glow with this triumph. Milk, moon, tree, feet, lizard, water, bus, neighbor, napkin. They echo my words in confirmation, one of them crying, God is great. The crone reaches over and pats Munira's knee. What a bizarre child, she says, and wipes her eyes. Truly, God is great.
Hmm. How wonderful your writing is. I love your sense of humor. You've been listening to Diana Abu-Jabbar read from The Language of Baklava, published by Anchor Books. How do you, in a memoir, get away with, say, recreating dialogue? I don't know if you have a sort of photographic memory and remember exactly what people say, and so you don't have a problem with that. But how does that happen?
It's hard. It's really hard. And, you know, I definitely, and unlike certain memoirists, I do admit at the beginning of the book that some of this is going to be filled out.
Mm-hmm.
And, so what I tried to do was, I remember the situation quite clearly, and I can remember conversations in their general form. And usually what I can do is I can pull back certain lines, I can pull back fragments and bits of conversation. Usually I can't recreate it, you know, that's just, it's too much, but I can kind of fill it out. And so I try with all my writing, you know, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, I very much like to evoke scene and action. And I wrote this memoir with the shape of a novel so that each of the chapters has a story-like arc to it. So there are bits in there that I just had to kind of estimate. And I always tried to get it as close to the original conversation as I can, but, you know, it's hard. It's hard to get it exactly perfect, and you just have to do the best you can.
Mm-hmm. What about legalities in terms of writing memoirs? What can you tell and not get sued over? I mean, do you have to worry about that? Are there things that once you had a draft and even a final draft that your publisher had a lawyer vet? Does that happen?
Well, I know that it does happen. I have some friends who've had that happen with their memoirs. I guess Anchor felt like, you know, The Language of Baklava seemed innocuous enough, I think, so they figured, well, we'll just go with it. And I suppose it's always a little bit of a risk whenever you write about other people. But, you know, it also gets into questions of freedom of speech. And, you know, I actually talked to a therapist about this. I was so, you know, just ratcheted up. Do I have the right to write about other people? Do I have the right to tell other people's stories? And she said something very helpful. She said, everybody owns their own story. She said, you have a right to tell your story the way you remember it, the way you feel like it happened to you, and they have a right to write their own book.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of, I went at it with that attitude, and, you know, I just tell people, please, please join the conversation, write a book. hear from you.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
So you can write your experience. And you do, I think you do give fictional names to people.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're plastering their names all over the place.
That is true. That is, well, some of the names actually are the real names.
Mm-hmm.
oh, man.
I remember a story you told at the Literary Guild a few weeks ago about relatives being upset, not that you wrote about them, but that you didn't write about them.
Right. Yeah, that was my cousin. Yeah, you know, it's one of these kinds of things that you really can't control this. It teaches me so much how little we own our own books. You know, we write them, and then we set them free into the world. And if you remember that, then you can kind of write loosely and you don't try to manage it too much. You know that people are going to bring their own interpretations no matter what you do.
Yeah. So. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Diana Abu-Jabbar, author of The Language of Baklava. So once you knew you were writing a memoir, how much of an outline did you create? How much of a structure was there?
Well, it's funny. This book, I wrote a little differently from the novels. And Arabian Jazz and Crescent, both those novels, I did pretty extensive outlines. And with The Language of Baklava, what I did instead was I wrote a list of all the important foods of my childhood. You know, everything that my father made regularly, my favorite foods, my most hated dishes. I wrote it all down in a big list. And then I just thought about, what do I remember about shish kebab? You know, what do I remember about hummus? And I did it like that. I just, and it was amazing. Things came back to me so vividly. The problem was almost picking which story I was going to tell. So it was like writing, almost like writing a short story collection.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. I got to write another one of these. So much easier than writing a novel. Oh. So,
are you working on a novel now?
I am, and it's just about killing me.
How so?
It's got a plot. It's awful. I don't know how to write a plot.
Is that how you write your fiction? Because you do have two novels out, Diana, that were critically acclaimed. And so you must know something here. And how did those come out?
It's tough. I think what I tend to do is I start with a character. There's somebody who I'm thinking about. With Crescent, you know, I was thinking about this chef. And actually, I was thinking about Middle Eastern food again, and I knew I wanted to spend time in a Middle Eastern restaurant. So it was starting with kind of a scene and working from the scene. Who comes into that scene? Who enters the restaurant?
Hmm.
Oh, and what conversations do they have? Oh, and then who comes in next? And kind of building out sequentially like that. And then when I revise it, I have to cut everything out and start all over again. So, you know, for me, a lot of my actual writing happens in the revision stage.
Do you pass your work through a lot of revisions?
I do. I really do. I mean, probably, I can't really say that it's from beginning to end, but I would say a minimum of 10 revisions before it comes out, and maybe more, you know. Just reworking, rereading, showing it to other people. You know, I'm a slow writer. I don't crank them out every year. It takes me several years to write my books. And, you know.
Do you ever hit points of boredom where you say to yourself, why will I go on with this? Why should I go on with this? Do you do that, or do those words not find their way into your brain?
Oh, I think you must have been sitting next to me in the office all day today because, oh, my God. I mean, that's all I was saying today. I was just like, why am I writing this? Who cares? Why am I adding to the weight of novels in the world? I'm just, oh. And I went out for lunch with a friend, and she said, listen, you know, I love you. Your family loves you. We want to read your work. And she told me a story that Alice Sebald apparently wrote a little card and wrote on it for the five people who will read this.
Hmm.
And she kept it in front of her while she was working on The Lovely Bones.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's true, but
yeah.
I love that image. So,
right.
Yeah.
Having a small audience of people that you know will want it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And trying not to think too much about the publication critics audience part, you know. Just think about the work.
Hmm. Yeah, that's good. That's good because it comes up especially when you hear I mean, for you, I don't think it's the same as, say, a new novelist because you have two novels, you have this memoir and other things. But I think for, especially for new novelists, the idea of putting something out there into the publishing industry, which, you know, we hear all the time is getting harder and harder to permeate. A lot of writers sitting there going, why bother?
Oh, yes, I know. I feel your pain. all those first novelists out there. I know it is. It's really, really tough. And you know, I take a lot of comfort from a little snippet that I think was from Bird by Bird, where she says that writing for publication is like learning the Japanese tea ceremony so you can get the tea. You know, so. It's got to be about the journey of the writing. It's got to be done for the joy of writing. And if publication comes, if acclaim comes, that's wonderful. But the only thing we can really control is the journey of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the great gift for all of us is when we get to do it. So, yeah.
Any surprises through writing this book, The Language of Baklava? Anything come out of it that you didn't expect?
Oh, I remember feeling like I was learning all kinds of things about family patterns that I hadn't seen before, certain kinds of traits and behaviors, and then I forgot all of it. It's like it got published, and it all went out straight out of my head. So I think that means it was successful because I didn't feel haunted by it. I just let those connections come up, and one real surprise that happened after the book came out was my father got really upset, and he had me come over and he said that he didn't like that I portrayed him yelling. He did not. He was yelling at me. He was saying, like, I don't yell. And I said, yes, you do, Dad. You yell all the time. You're a big yeller. And he said, oh, I do. And then he said, well, even if I do yell, you didn't have to write a book and tell everybody in the world about it. And I said, well, you're right. I didn't. But I did. And, you know, I mean, this is the danger of having children, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
Grow up and write a book about you.
That's right.
But, see. But you know, it was very interesting in learning what I thought happened and what my parents thought happened and what my siblings thought happened. So a lot of the discovery came after the book came out.
Mm. Well, it's wonderful to have you on the show again. I think you were on, gosh, quite a few years ago with your first book, with Arabian Jazz.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's been quite a while, but
yeah.
another wonderful book from you, and we can only look forward to more. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Barbara. It was great fun.
That was Diana Abu-Jabbar
author of The Language of Baklava, a memoir published by Anchor Books. And we are at the end of our time again. So if you want to know more about the show, you can go to my website, which is Pen on Fire. And there you can email me if you'd like to be on the weekly email list. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Toni Morrison, who said, "I always know the ending. That's where I start." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire, and I'll talk to you soon.